Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Andrea Brown Phillips. I am with the Aspen Institute, and I'm pleased to welcome you to today's luncheon session. We have a very special speaker with us today. We had the privilege of having her at our Aspen Environment Forum in March as one of our keynote speakers, and we were so pleased we had to invite her back to Aspen again as part of the festival. A few housekeeping notes before we begin the session. These lovely friends that we all have, we gladly request that you turn them off. This session is being recorded for broadcast. Also, if you do have any questions, because we're recording the session, please stand by and Larissa will bring the mic to you. So please don't ask your questions before the mic actually gets to you. Majora is one of the few respected and individuals with integrity in the environmental area of our day. And we are proud to have her and proud that she's a friend of the Institute. And we're going to have one of our fellows that you've heard throughout the festival giving one of his big ideas, Mr. Eric Weaver. He's the CEO of Opportunity Fund in San Jose, and he'll be giving you a few words shortly. So do enjoy. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. So in just a couple moments, we're going to be hearing from Majora Carter, and her work focuses not just on environmental issues, but on issues of poverty in the inner city. And my big idea also relates to poverty and the issues of working people. At Opportunity Fund, our mission is to improve the economic well-being of working people by helping them to earn, save, and invest in their future. And what I want to talk about is poverty from the perspective of wealth, as opposed to income. Those of us that do work in this area have increasingly come to see in recent years that wealth and assets are as important, if not more important, than income. And sociologists, when they've studied this, have been able to show that wealth is probably the single, if you control for everything else, you control for race, income, education, that it's how much wealth a family has that's most predictive of how a family's gonna do, how children are gonna do. So we really need to have policies in this country that are gonna help families build wealth. And the good news is we have a very robust set of policies in this country to encourage asset building, to basically to subsidize it. About $400 billion a year goes into subsidizing asset accumulation for people in the U.S., and it's all done through the tax code. So when you pay your mortgage interest, you can deduct that from your taxable income. That's a subsidy to you. When you put money in a 401k, you can deduct that from your taxable income. That's a subsidy. It ramps up your return. Same with when you have capital gains income, it's taxed at a lower level than other types of income. So that kind of accumulation is subsidized. But the problem is that $400 billion, virtually none of it goes to the people who need it most. Just a couple statistics. Of that $400 billion, 45% of it, nearly half, goes to the top 1% of households in the country. That's households with an average income of $1.25 million getting this subsidy. Meanwhile, the bottom 60%, so well over half of the country, gets 3% of it. Put it another way, if you're in one of those households of the top 1%, you get on average $58,000 in tax subsidies through these policies, whereas if you're in the bottom 20%, you get about $3. So, and it is a subsidy. I mean, it's money you don't have to, you know, that you hang on to. So the reason that working people don't get any access to this is they pay very little income tax. They pay a lot of payroll tax, but they pay very little income tax, which is a good thing. But what we need to do is, my big idea is that we really change our tax policy. We take some of that $400 billion or add to it and create a refundable tax refund for working families, low-income families. So when they fill out their tax return, if they've managed to put some money away into an IRA or a 529, or if they own a home and have paid mortgage interest, they should get a check back from the IRS to bump up their return the same way middle-income and upper-income people have their returns bumped up. Lastly, I'll say we know the poor can save. We have our program. Go to our website, opportunityfund.org. If you give people incentives and the proper structures, they can save money even at very low-income levels. I mean, it's tremendous things. So now I'm going to turn the mic over to a person I think has far bigger ideas than I do, and please join me in welcoming Majora Carter.
Thank you. Thanks very much. So, a quick question to tech guys. Use both of these mics or just this one?
Okay. Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for having me and actually sitting indoors and such on such a gorgeous day. Someone entitled this session "Hope in the Inner City," and this is my life and this is my work. But I'll be honest, sometimes it doesn't seem so hopeful in the inner city. You know, we're still, you know, in many parts of the country, you know, we still have incredibly high teen pregnancy rates, poverty rates, etc. But there is this interesting sort of, you know, popular mythology around, you know, some folks, you know, kind of like me, that have sort of, you know, accomplished some really interesting things in their lives that have come from the inner city, you know, whose parents really had pretty much nothing and have done some great work. And I'm not trying to discount that, because I think the light, it really was a bit of a Cinderella story in a lot of ways. But I'm really interested in moving the mythology, you know, to take it from hope in the inner city and move it beyond it to, like, how can we all become the seven samurais? Okay, more on that later. But anyway, it really does come back to that. But interestingly enough, I'm from the South Bronx, and I grew up there during a time when the financial disinvestment pretty much said that cities were emptying out into the suburbs. Things like planned shrinkage happening, where cities would literally start denying, you know, goods and services, you know, to inner cities, because that's just what was happening at the time. And my parents moved up from down south as part of the great American migration, you know, of blacks looking for a much better life, and, you know, came up to a white working class community where they often walked to work in many ways. And my parents' history was very, very much, you know, symbolic of what was going on around the rest of the country at the time. And it was a great life for them for a while. But again, the financial disinvestment made it so that highway construction started happening then. In my neighborhood alone, we lost about 500,000 people as highways kept getting built throughout communities, you know, as ways to make it easier for wealthier counties to connect with each other, from Manhattan and Westchester in particular. So places like my neighborhood in the South Bronx simply became, you know, thoroughfares or big parking lots for people to get through en route from one place to another. It became easier because with redlining happened, where bank presidents decided that it wasn't such a good idea to make investments in their own communities. So we found many landlords were torching their own buildings to collect insurance money, rather than trying to find money that was not coming their way to make investments in their community. So what we saw was a financial situation that literally created the kind of environmental problems that I now work against right now. And so we saw huge amounts of whole areas of our community, literally just sort of where there was areas of light manufacturing, where there were businesses that once thrived, were totally just laid open and bare. And what moved in? Literally garbage companies. And the garbage companies, with tons of diesel pollution, you know, also paved the way, you know, for lots of other things like power plants, sewage sludge pelletizing plants. All these things had an incredible, incredible impact on our communities, public health in particular. And I remember when I was a little girl, even before those things happening, I remember when I was 7 years old, I watched the building on my corner burn down. And, you know, I got to tell you, there was a parts of my neighborhood that I absolutely loved before the fire started. You know, it was a community. It was a place that, you know, I knew my neighbors, and they knew me. And when I was 7 years old, I watched the building on my corner burn down, and firemen didn't come to save people. It was, you know, the guys from down the street and across the street from me who went up to save people, because there were no fire people coming at that time. You know, after the building was evacuated, that's when they came in to put the fire out. You know, my own brother was killed as a result of much of the drug wars that were going on there. And I remember thinking, I got to get out of here. And so by the time, you know, all the manufacturing had left, and by the time, you know, all the garbage companies had moved in, I was ready to go. And I knew I was a smart kid, and I was out. You know, I went away. I went to the Bronx High School of Science, which is in New York City, one of, like, a public school with a private school education. And I was real excited to go, because I knew it was going to set me up to go to college, and so that I could turn my back on my neighborhood. And I did. I would pretend that I wasn't from the South Bronx. I would tell people that I was from the East Bronx, you know, if they bothered to ask me or something like that. It was like I'd make crap up on the spot. And but it was this deep sense of shame that I was associated with the hopelessness that was my neighborhood. And it was only under duress when I came back home. I mean, I literally was starting grad school. I was going to be, you know, I was creative writing at NYU, and I was so excited about the possibility of writing a great American novel, turning it to the great American screenplay, and playing a little supporting role in the movie that I would, of course, direct. And lo and behold, it didn't quite happen because I was broke and had to live with my parents, and I still hated it there. But then I got to know my neighborhood in another crazy way. You know, like I realized that funny smell in the neighborhood wasn't there because people didn't care. It was there because I got politicized. You know, I realized that communities don't just happen because the people that are in them, you know, just don't necessarily care. Our community was literally structured so that as it grew poorer and more politically disenfranchised, that the kind of thing, the things that wealthier communities could afford to avoid would be placed there. And Giuliani and Pataki, our mayor and governor, were utterly complicit in trying to bring more of that to the neighborhood. And that's when I moved back home and discovered that they were trying to build this huge waste facility that would have brought 40% of the city's waste to our waterfront, despite the fact that we were already handling 40% of the city's waste at the time. And again, the politicization, you know, of me was like one of those things where I did have this rather righteous indignation. And all I could think was, like, this, we've got to stop this. And eventually, we were able to do so, but not before we had to take assessment of the community. And people in our neighborhoods were just like, you know, I would be alarmed. And many folks would be like, well, what are you so freaked out about? Clearly, you haven't been here a long time, because this is what happens. It's the South Bronx. But once they made the connection, and once we helped them make the connection between the fact that they would take their kids to the emergency room twice a month to get their air passages, you know, opened up because of an asthma or a bronchitis attack, then they made the connection between the environment that was perpetuated against our community and their public health. And that's when they started to understand, like, oh, wait a second, this is something that we need to work on. But the other thing was that we knew what to fight against. Many of us didn't know what to fight for. We were not ever really given a position to think about, well, what do we want? Like, we know we don't want that because it's hurting our kids and their lungs, but what do we really want? And when we ask folks, well, what, you know, what kind of dreams do you have for your own future? And people would say things like, well, you know, it'd be nice for my kid to go for a walk and go to a park in their own neighborhood and not get hit by a truck. It would be nice, you know, to know that we can breathe clean air. It'd be really nice to have a job, you know, in our own community that's not going to destroy the environment or me. Are these huge, enormous things for people to ask? They're like basic, simple human rights, if you ask me. And so in response to that, I found a life's mission, literally. And the first thing we needed to do was fight that waste facility. But at the same time, we also had to show the community that we could think about something else, that we could be seen as beautifully and as proudly as we wanted to see ourselves and wanted others to see us. And I got my gift, you know, in the form of a dog, a big, grungy, 80-pound mutt who literally dragged me into a lot, what I thought was another abandoned parking, you know, just, you know, illegal dump in my neighborhood. Turns out that it dead-ended in the Bronx River, which is exactly the same thing that people were looking to put, like, little seed grants for restoration money into. And we ended up, I looked at this place and was like, this could be the beginning of my neighborhood's waterfront restoration. This could be how we want to define ourselves, as opposed to the garbage that we're constantly being shown all the time, and that we somehow internalize as being dirty ourselves. And we were able to turn that into the most amazing park, you know, our, not just the first waterfront park our community had in more than 60 years, but it was also, I believe, the most beautiful park our city has ever had, and after $3 million worth of investments. But that was just a start. That was just a means to an end, because it didn't really, not even that really met people's real creature comfort and needs, you know, for developing into like the, what they really needed to be. And I remember thinking, you know, someone, and I still don't know how I got this in my hands. I got this study from the University of Illinois, and it showed, like, what were the impacts of urban forestry, you know, on people's health. And they went to Cabrini Green, like one of the most notorious public housing projects in the country, you know, at the time. And they showed some really crazy things, like one, that if you had a small grove of urban street trees, that people who lived near there, that their stress levels would go down. That if you had a little bit more, that crime rates would go down because people enjoyed being outside. And there were eyes on the street, and people wanted to be more with each other, and it was an increase in community pride. And I was like, trees do that? You know, I was like, they do. I mean, I didn't grow up with any, so how would I know? But lo and behold, they did. And so the park thing was just like one way of doing that. And then we realized there could also be jobs associated with this, because we noticed that as we worked to revitalize our waterfront, that they would import people to come in and do that work. And we were like, you know, we've got a 25% unemployment rate in our community. We could, what if we actually trained our people in the skills of ecological restoration ourselves? Okay. And ended up getting a grant. And at the same time, I was actually just starting, you know, understanding that what we needed to do was not just, you know, advocate against something, but fight for things. And we were real excited to do that. So starting my own agency, Sustainable South Bronx, which all we do is create alternatives to much of the polluting infrastructure that often defines poor communities and poor communities of color. And its principle is environmental justice, which very simply means that no community should have to bear the brunt of lots of environmental burdens and not enjoy some environmental benefits. And right now, unfortunately, race and class will tell you exactly where you find the good stuff, like parks and trees, and where you find the bad stuff. You know, in my neighborhood, it would look like sewage sludge pelletizing plants or 60,000 diesel truck trips. But if you go to Appalachia, you would find the tops of mountaintops removed and cyanide poured down them, you know, destroying the water table and the people that live near them. So again, it's not just about race, it's also about class. And so it's really important for folks, just because you see a black chick up here talking to you about it, that ain't all it's about. So starting my agency was really about, like, how do we redefine ourselves? How do we have both an environmental and an economic stake in making our surroundings better? How do we all play a part of that? How do we, like, make sure that even the folks that have been left out of every single, like, major economic boom, you know, in this country and definitely in our neighborhood? Because believe me, we have the world's largest food distribution center in our community, which adds billions into New York City's economy. We share none of it. We are the poorest congressional district in the country. So we get all the burdens from having 60,000 diesel trucks going through our neighborhood. We don't really even get most of the jobs that go through there. So again, how do we create this kind of, you know, mechanism that will allow people to grow and be a part of the betterment of the environment and also improve their own, you know, financial and even spiritual, and I would even, you know, dare say, you know, all their own mental well-being as well. And so starting my organization was definitely a piece of that. And so starting, you know, advocating for more parks and greenways in our community was one way. Could I close this? Do you mind? I'm a little distracted. Sorry. I'm like, what are they talking about out there? Thank you. Where am I? I have no clue. Somewhere near. Oh, I know. So anyway, so started the organization, you know, as a means to create real tangible items that would allow us to improve the quality of life in our community economically and environmentally. And of course, the spiritual and I think emotional, mental aspects come along with that as well. So we've done things like everything from advocating for greenway development in our community. I wrote the first, the city's the biggest, largest influx of good planning dollars to ever come into our community, $1.25 million to design a feasibility study for the Greenway, which is a collection of on-street and on-water bike paths, which have both an economic as well as a recreational component to them as well. We got about $20 million to actually start those projects starting early fall this year. And so that was one thing. Thank you. We also started our own green roof installation business because we believe that we're building markets, you know, for green jobs in our own neighborhood. Green roofs is a real beautiful, sustainable building technology that's been done for more than 50 years at this point in Europe, where they literally plant a roof with just kind of structured soil medium and also plants, so that you're, one, cleaning the air, because it's a green layer. Two, it actually provides an energy conservation layer so that you can actually lower your energy bills, especially in the summertime. It attracts storm water, and that's really important because as we, climate change is happening. It's not like we're going to stop it. It's been happening for a while now. And we're seeing more intense storms going forward. So you want as many things that attract and hold storm water so that you're not going to be building so you don't have to continue to build huge sewage treatment plants that frankly get obsolete like the second you finish building them. So the more you can actually work with nature and take advantage of the environmental services that she so beautifully does by actually mimicking, her work and providing jobs in the process, I think you're doing a really good thing. So doing that kind, so creating more green roof installation in your around as well is really important as too. We're trying to tear down, some of the highways that got built that never should have been built in the first place. In particular, one that is only a mile and a quarter long. It doesn't go anywhere, but it still got built. And we're showing that if you get rid of that and create 28 acres of, you'd have 28 acres of developable land, which could, in fact, create more parkland, community economic development, even transportation systems and housing that would actually bring tens of millions of dollars worth of wages to our communities and more than 600 permanent jobs as well. So my agency, along with some other groups, are working on that project, and it's really very exciting about that. But the thing that we are most proud of, our signature project, is called BEST, which stands for Bronx Environmental Stewardship Training. And, again, as we work to revitalize our community, and we saw it on the Bronx River, that, we were working to revitalize it, but we weren't the ones most involved in actually working to, build up these great assets. We realized that we had to train people to do that work. So we got our initial funding actually through a small congressional appropriation, and we were able to train people in our community. And now the program's evolved into a 10-week training program that trains people on anything from urban forestry to green roof installation to cleaning up contaminated land safely or brownfield remediation. We're moving into solar installation and also building retrofits so that we can train folks. And many of them, I got to tell you, most of the folks that do come through our program, almost all have been on public assistance. Good portion of them, have spent some time in our criminal justice system. And so they are considered traditionally, they've got some huge barriers to employment. So developing, jobs in this green sector is incredibly important as a way to help get people, like move them up an economic ladder in ways that really didn't exist before. And so training people in these things, and I got to tell you, it's like, especially when I see folks, one of my dearest friends at this point is a young single mom, she has three kids. She actually never had a job before because she'd been in the social welfare system all her time, and it was at her first kid, I think at like 16. And she went through our program, and she's like a superstar because she became alive to the world around her when she started to understand that the work of her hands, the dignity that she was able to provide, in terms of caring for an environment, something that she thought that she'd never have any real impact on, but understanding that it was literally the strength of her that was changing the environment around her, and that her children would grow up and see her do this. I mean, we're talking power, the likes of which, if we can do that for more people, just imagine the kind of America that we would be living in. And it's possible because it really, really is. I mean, if we run a little podunk, group in the South Bronx, and if we've been changing lives like that, imagine if we did this on a national scale. I mean, I think the last time that we really sort of tried to figure out what could we be doing, you know, how could we work together in search of an ideal that is so much bigger than we ever could be. You know, I think of my father, who would have been 102 this year. And, literally, he had me pretty late in life. My mother was much younger. And, you know, I think about the fact that he was too old to join the Guard he wanted to go and fight in World War II. He was too old at the time, so he joined the Guard. But he was willing and able to fight and shed his own blood for this country, in a country where he had to leave the South because of the threat of being lynched. But that was the promise of America. He was fighting for the promise of what it could be. The same way that the folks that go through our programs, you know, see that even though we're in a really desperate situation right now with climate crisis, with global poverty, and we know that incomes are not going to rise as sea levels do, or at least not for most people, you know, we know that. But many of us are so willing to recognize that we are in an amazingly pivotal and critical moment in the history of our country right now. And we have an opportunity to use the green economy to move people out of poverty. I mean, we were able to link, you know, the idea of poverty remediation and environmental remediation on a small scale in the South Bronx, and we've gotten tremendous results. More than 85% of the people that have gone through our job training program are still employed, you know, after we track them for a number of years after we work with them. And imagine if we were able to do that on a larger scale. And again, if we can do both of them, and we absolutely can, and that's what this is all about. How do we, you know, take the crisis that we're in right now environmentally and make superheroes and superstars of everybody? Because it's not just going to be, you know, the eco elite that's going to get us out of this. It's just not. We won World War II in large part because everybody in America fought. Everybody. Didn't matter what color you were. It didn't matter what sex you were. It didn't matter what class you were from. We are at that point right now. And at this point, we have, I think, a moral obligation to the future of our country. And you're talking to a person who has no interest in having children. So the whole idea of somebody saying, do it for your children, it pretty much doesn't mean anything to me. And so I can understand why it doesn't mean much to most people as they, you know, do their own thing. But just think about the future, just what future generations are going to be saying about us. Like, are we going to be talked about in the same glowing terms that we often talk about heroes of the past? Or are we going to be talked about, you know, it's like, well, you know, they had an opportunity to do something. But I think that this green economy moment that we're in right now can give us all the opportunity. We can make heroes, you know, of poor folks all over this country by giving them the kind of training that they need in order to participate. You know, because again, you can't take your house if you want to put solar panels on it. You're not going to take it to China to have it, you know, solar panels put on it. You're just not. And the environmental services, you know, of green roof installation, of stormwater management, you know, the kind of things that green roofs and street trees and all those kind of things actually can provide, you know, actually creating eco-industrial parks, collections of businesses that use recycled materials as raw materials, as opposed to like landfilling them, you know, in state, you know, on the states around the country, or, you know, even sending them, you know, in not so great repair over to places like China where there's less environmental regulations. You know, how are we going to recognize that there's things that we can do and do proudly? And I am really proud of the fact that I'm actually a co-founder of a group called Green for All, which is a national strategy organization that wants to create pathways out of poverty and to move people out of poverty. And Van Jones is going to be at a panel with me a little bit later on, and Anna DeVere Smith is going to be moderating that. And so, but Van really was the brains behind, like, how do you know, on especially on the federal level, actually, even in the administration that we're in right now, how do you, like, carve out a piece of it so that we could actually create some money to do job training? And in last year's energy bill, it, you know, which was basically a love song, you know, to the energy and coal industry, there was $125 million in it for green job training going around the country. and it hasn't been appropriated yet. But that's the kind of thing, like, how do you make sure that those kind of, that on the federal level, that there's funding and regulations in place and incentives to actually do the kind of new green world that we need to see? Like, we don't have, you know, Roosevelt here with us right now, but we do have all of us. We do have all of us who can push our electives. We do have all of us, you know, who can, you know, work in our own lifestyles, you know, to create an understanding of what can be better. You know, we do have an understanding of understanding how connected we all are. And I sometimes think we don't necessarily do that. You know, the same way that, you know, Robert Moses, who was the guy who was most involved in creating the changing the face of New York City with the highway constructions, you know, didn't really think at all about the communities that were being destroyed as a result of the highways that were being built through it in the name of progress. We sometimes don't necessarily think of what's happening, you know, with garbage when we throw it away. You know, what happens to it? It's nothing. There is no such thing as a way. You know, however, if we saw all of our self-interest tied up with each other, if we recognize that it is a much more valuable and humane thing for us to do, to recognize that we train people who were mostly considered problems before, like such as in the inner cities, you know, if they're considered problems before and we're training them to be active, important parts of our society. Because you know what? If we don't train them to do that, unfortunately, as we've seen, the prison industrial complex is getting paid lots, you know, on the backs of many poor people around this country. I mean, we spend more money locking up folks in our communities and around this country, much, much more so than the entire EU combined. Yet our crime rates are still up. We don't have the social systems that actually support people at all. And so when we talk about, or when I talk about the fact that we spend, I'm sorry, America produces 25% of the world's greenhouse gases. We also produce 25% of the world's prison population. 25% of both. They are linked. The fact that we consider so much of our sort of disposable culture has allowed us to think that we could throw anything away, including people. Are we at all wondering why we're in the situation that we're in right now? But the beautiful thing is, we don't have to stay there. We don't. We have all the skills and the tools available to us right now. All of us do. We can do it politically. We can do it, you know, internally. We can do it spiritually. I really, truly believe that. And I do think that now more than ever, we've got an opportunity with the whole idea that the green economy is going to be an economy that's not going to, like, go but walk away from poor communities. Because, again, I even think that, and actually there's plenty of stats out there to show you, that poverty is what is often at the root of pretty much all of our ills. People go to jail, many of them. Like, granted, there's some people that we don't, not a prison abolitionist, believe me, there should be jails. And because some folks, you know, really are not, should not be let out into public society. But most people, when you really look at the stats, many of them are just there because they couldn't afford things like bail. Or, you know, sold a little bit of pot to, like, buy their kids some shoes. These are the stories that I often hear. And they're the stories that many people don't know or don't want to hear about. And unfortunately, there are other things that we can do to create opportunities for everybody so that everybody can be a star. And that's really all that this is about. It really is. How do we create the kind of economy that doesn't leave people out? And considering that we are in a crisis right now, this is an opportunity that we have. Because, like, I really, you know, just a couple months ago, we, Green for All hosted a conference called The Dream Reborn. And it was started on the 40th anniversary of the day that Martin Luther King was assassinated. And it was called A Dream Reborn because we wanted to make sure that Martin and everybody else knew that the dream didn't die with him. And And so I like to think, you know, especially, you know, realizing at the end of his life, he was talking as much about economic justice as he was about racial justice. And I think on so many levels, that is one of the reasons why he was assassinated. Because when you start talking about that poverty is something that's going to bring us all down, people of all colors, then those are scary things, because it also means that if poor people and you know, allies recognize the power that we could bring to the table, then that in and of itself is a revolution. I think one worth having, but it is a revolutionary thing. And but, you know, I absolutely feel that when Martin was up there, you know, gave that prophetic speech, you know, he'd been to the mountaintop, you know, and he looked out and saw the promised land. Do you think he saw a quarter of America's population in jail? Do you think he saw children often dying from completely preventable environmentally caused illnesses? Do you think he saw opportunities denied? Do you think he saw the fact that we couldn't, that we should be using this our country, the land that it is, as opportunities to completely just abuse it? I don't think he saw any of that. But what he did see was a future that was green for all of us, each and every one of us. And that's what this is all about. And and so my hope is that all of you will join me in the hopes of literally tearing down those monuments to our collective failures and building, you know, monuments to hope and possibility. So thank you very much. So are there any questions?
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Sherman from Washington, D.C. I run Presidential Classroom, which is a program for young people. And I think that probably everyone in this room agrees with everything you said and supports you 100%. I think we'd all want to ask you, what can we do? If you were looking at all of us as a group of supporters or volunteers, what would you want all of us to do?
One would be support Green for All and Sustainable South Bronx, because there really are groups working on the ground and nationally to help support these things. You know, two, I really, and this might sound a little goofy, but I really meant it when I wanted people to really stop and sensuously think about how interconnected we are, because it's really easy for us to just sort of think, oh, you know, if you don't see it, you know, Americans, I think, are fantastic at putting blinders on. In particular, like, you know, if you don't see it, it doesn't really affect you. And we've got to, like, let ourselves be vulnerable in that way. Because once you start seeing, you know, folks that are, like, I'll give you an example. You know, folks have been fighting against, you know, the disproportionate amount of waste in the South Bronx for many, many years. Okay. It wasn't until we actually started to get some of our allies, you know, people that, you know, didn't want to not support us. They were just sort of like, how bad could it possibly be? You know, it wasn't until we brought them up to see and to smell stuff that they were just like, this exists in New York City? Horrified. But, you know, it didn't matter, like, what we wrote. It didn't matter the reports until they saw it. And the thing is, like, not everybody's going to come to a place like the South Bronx. They're just not. But you know what? Take our word for it. And, you know, and recognize that there's South Bronxes all over the place. And so that, I mean, but I think, and it's much easier if you can, let's really sensuously understand that there are people who, we need to do this all together. You know, like, it never occurred to me, like, when I first started this work, that, you know, me as a black girl from the inner city would feel as much solidarity as I do right now with folks from coal country. It just, you know, it wasn't like I didn't, you know, wasn't against it. I just didn't think about it. But now I know. It's just like, wait a second. Their liberation is completely tied up in mine, because where we're going to find But where we're going to find, you know, resources to help deal with the crisis that we're in right now is going to be with us all working together and recognizing that many people from different aspects of society are working together. Okay. And the other thing is really pushing, you know, we need to make sure that we've got support going forward for the kind of legislation that we need to see happening. We need to be pushing for the kind of regulations that are going to be supportive, because we want, you know, the market isn't going to be the only thing that's going to do this. We need to have both things working in current, you know, concurrently to make sure that it happens. As we're working to build green businesses, we need to make sure that there's going to be funds allocated for green job training as well, you know, on the city, states, and local levels. I'm sorry, federal levels. And we're going to need to know that all those things are going to come back to us, because the bottom line is, you know, pay me now, pay me later. You know, the problem is that we've got, you know, the kind of crisis that the environmental abuses and degradations that we're dealing in right now are already coming at the cost, you know, of public health crisis, the money that is spent, you know, in incarceration, you know, for people that could be used to actually support us, those kind of things. And again, it's, you know, how do we want to allocate our resources in support of a better future?
Hi, Sarah Horowitz from the Freelancers Union and friend of Adria Goodson. Hi.
Sorry.
So I would love to hear, of the allies that you've made, which have been interesting to you, which have been kind of like strange bedfellows, what have been sort of happy surprises along the way?
Gosh, the strangest bedfellows was our was the huge scrap metal yard that was right next door to where our first park was being built. Because before they had no idea. The management really had no idea what the employees were doing day to day, and they kept dumping stuff in the river, and we kept calling and getting them fined. And again, once they came up and realized, oh, wait, there are people up there who are trying to do stuff, let's help them even more. And so they've actually became like incredible, incredible allies. And they're actually, it turns out that they're a pretty big, very well-moneyed company. So it helps. Yeah.
Hello, I'm Edith Caperton, president and founder of the Worldwide Workshop Foundation, and from New York. And thank you so much for sharing your beautiful vision and passion and how you're linking poverty elimination with the green economy and training people to get job and the community kind of building. The missing link for me was something about education and really the same training you do with young adults or adults, maybe start very young. Maybe even in preschool and kindergarten, yes. All the elementary schools and high schools, to really activate them, maybe even using technology or gaming, mm-hmm. or really being the organizers of all these people around them to really think about what you're doing in the
yes.
South Bronx,
yes.
In education. So yeah. Who is your education partner?
Right. Well, there's actually two parts to that. We started working, you know, with an older population, because there have been so many. We have several failed generations of people, you know, in our community. The way we figured that we would deal with helping to stabilize our community was making sure that people had jobs. So that was one thing you should know. And that would in turn help their children as well, because no matter how great the education system is, if the kids are going back into a home, you know, with parents that are suffering the distresses of poverty and everything else, like the kids' lives are going to not so be so great no matter what. But to that point, and just to let you know, people kept bugging us to start a school, and I was like, we can't do it. It's like, it's just too much. We can barely keep our head above water now. But it was only when I realized that the city was planning on building like a 2,000-bed jail in my neighborhood, when I realized that, you know what? Suddenly, Jora Carter just became a prison reform activist. And and then we started working on the development of a school, because I was like, well, wait, by the time this jail is built, it'll be ready for the crop, you know, of like 10-year-olds right now. And I thought, dear God, no. So we actually are working to start a school that will open in 2009, and it starts with sixth graders. And the whole point of it is that their community is their classroom. We'll be working very closely with, and it'll be aligned with Sustainable South Bronx, so that the school becomes its classroom, and then they become really immersed, you know, in the skills of social activism, community investment. Yeah, basically. Yeah, we want to create like a whole bunch of, like a whole little generation of activists, but not just, but the kind of activists who aren't just fighting for the sake of fighting, but see the vision and see the goals and see the glory of what a world is going to be like with them in it. And I just think that, oh God, it makes me like really weepy almost just to think about like some of the kids that we're working with right now and how they're just so young and all they want to do is just do something good. They just need just a little bit of support to do it. And yeah, I mean, look at me, you know?
I like the concept of green collar workers. Maybe you have green collar learners.
Yes, we all are. We are all green collar learners. We thank you very much.
I work for the mayor of Louisville, Kentucky, and we too have a section of town where we had environmental degradation that we're just beginning to understand. Chemical factories came after the war. They provided good jobs, but we're beginning to understand just the impacts. So my question is, are you doing replication? We want you.
To some extent. Yes. And so Green for All is actually working, you know, how do we create mechanisms for that to happen on the ground. And just to let you know, it's not out in the world just yet, but I just wanted you to know that I'm actually stepping away from day-to-day management at Sustainable South Bronx and starting my own green consulting business, which will be working nationwide, to actually help businesses, municipalities, community groups, of course, and even universities help kind of create the kind of green-collar visions for themselves, because this is all replicable. We made a lot of mistakes. I would like for the country to benefit from that. And so that's why I realized that the next best thing for me to do was actually to know that my agency was actually in fantastic hands and see if there's any other possibilities out there for the kind of work that we've done. Because I know that there's folks that want to see it happen, and I'm real excited about that. I think we've got time for one more. Yes.
My name is Mary Holland. I live in New York. I teach at NYU Law School. And as I listen to you, and this is an incredibly hopeful story, as a New Yorker, I think gentrification, gentrification, gentrification.
Yes.
And how are you looking towards those secondary problems that will inevitably come?
One of our mottos is you don't have to move out of your neighborhood to live in a better one. Another thing that we talk about is that what we're trying to do with the whole economic piece of our work is all about moving people out of poverty. Like, I want to see less poor people, frankly, and creating, you know, opportunities for a new green economy, for more green jobs, for more access for folks to be able to do that work, actually puts them in a position, because when you're, and I can speak from experience, when you are that poor, the last thing you're thinking about doing is fighting for your own rights. When you know that you've got something to fight for, and unfortunately, having a little bit of an economic base, and it may sound crass, but bottom line is people who feel invested and have a little bit of money will act accordingly. Like, you're not going to like kick folks out of some place when they know their rights. But if they feel as though they don't have the right to have a right, then they don't do it. And so that's why it's really important for us to create opportunities so that people can actually have a financial stake right where they are. And their communities will benefit as a result of it as well. So that's real. So there will be some, absolutely, but there will also be displacement of some of the elements in our poor communities that we don't want either. You know, like, what you'll find that as neighborhoods get better and better services, you'll find that the kind of, you know, that some of the illicit economy goes away. Most of the people that are hard workers in our community don't want to see that stuff anyway. So we're working to make our community a better one without leaving it. So I think that's it. What? Oh, okay. 2 minutes. Okay. Oh, my clock's off. Okay, great.
Hi, Majora. I'm Suzanne Farber. I met you a couple of months ago at the Environmental Forum. And at that point, you were talking about going to Kansas City to speak about the rooftop gardens and some of those ideas, because they were looking at revamping their sewage treatment plant. Mm-hmm. And I just want to know how that went.
Well, they're still working on it. The last time I checked, it wasn't what they wanted to do was actually create, like many a small American cities, which is most of them, you know, under 200 or so thousand people, Kansas City was about to spend or about to move into this process where they're going to spend tens of billions of dollars, you know, revamping their stormwater management system. And it's, again, as global warming continues on its trend, you're going to see more of this. So some folks there were really excited about the idea of using green infrastructure, you know, green roofs, you know, more, you know, planted street trees, et cetera, to actually act at, to use those for the environmental services they provide, in particular stormwater management. So the last I heard was that there was they were successful in actually trying to turn a portion of that money that was going to go to that into some of the environmental services, but it hasn't been approved yet, so we're not quite sure. But hopefully I'll be able to help them do a little bit more. Yeah.
Majora, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the challenges and the lessons learned from getting employers, the local green employers, to hire the graduates of the BEST program, mm-hmm. and whether any of the graduates have actually started some of their own green companies.
Yes. So much of it is about relationship building. The woman who runs, the director of our program, Annette Williams, actually has a lot of experience in job development. And so one of her bigger jobs was to literally find out who the employers were and just develop a relationship with them. And if they've got, you know, and what the employers would actually realize if they got, you know, if it went through her and went through our program, then they would feel more comfortable. And they would, many of them would often just say, you know what? It doesn't even matter what they can do. We'll train them. We just want to make sure that they've got, that they're the kind of folks that we know we can work with. And so, because in many of the places that we work with, the barriers to employment, you know, in terms of incarceration, et cetera, that's not such a big deal right now, although we're discovering as we move into building retrofits that it absolutely is going to be, because many of the companies need to be bonded and you can't, through insurance, and you can't, many of them have restrictions in terms of hiring folks who are formerly incarcerated. So that's going to be a huge barrier for us that we're going to have to deal with in order to make sure that we can continue to get you know, people employed as well. But really, it's so much about relationship building. I mean, it's just being there, you know, and being the folks that go and walk with them. And we're actually starting another module of our program that's, you know, to give folks the entrepreneurial, you know, training to start there, because there actually has been a whole bunch of interest, you know, from folks. But again, it's another part of the program that we need to, you know, get some funding for. But it's, yeah, but that's our goal. It's not just, you know, there's obviously great dignity in work and working, but there's also, it's also really cool to have your own business, be your own boss. Yeah. And I know that too. Okay. One more. Okay.
You just led into what I was going to ask about. I'm Frank Altman with Community Reinvestment Fund. Is the green economy turning into green businesses that can grow and prosper in areas like South Bronx? And you have businesses that are looking for capital because we have capital.
Oh, really? I have a business for you. Yes. Okay. Are there businesses? The whole idea is, like, we think everything should be a green business. The businesses that are operating now should eventually, like, make their operations more green. But yes, we also do think that this is an amazing opportunity to develop new ones. Like the, I think I might have mentioned the eco-industrial park. We did a feasibility study for it already, collection of businesses on, it's one of the most, I think, beautiful pieces of land in all of New York. It's an industrial piece of land, but that's like my idea of beauty. It's got both bars and rail access. So you can actually take trucks off the road. We wanted to have a collection of businesses that use recycled materials as raw materials so that, you know, you could create hundreds of jobs, you know, through that process and, you know, deal with, you know, an enormous amount of waste that might end up in a landfill any old way. So, you know, again, creating, you know, adding value to those things. So, yes, I've got a feasibility study for you right now. And, yes, we're constantly, you know, looking for folks that want to see more of, you know, that are looking to, you know, create more opportunities in places like that. But, yes, I'd love to talk to you a little bit further about that. And it's not, and the bottom line is there are places like this, and I could tell you a list of places like all over the country, you know, that are looking, you know, for the kind of financing that you're offering and who have, or people that are ready and willing, you know, to be there and to would train folks, you know, for you. So, yeah, they're out there. I mean, I'm telling you, this is like the next new thing. All right, I'm giving the time up kind of thingy. All right, let's go. Thank you.